resume the hearing. Thank you. Start with questions, Ms. Jones. I have. I'll just start. And I want to bounce off your summary. You heard the question I posed to Mr. Heath that he was unable to answer regarding the size of the Corona Valley Road local shopping centre, which is, how is it that the council's section 32 analysis got itself to the position that 2.7 hectares was the most appropriate way to achieve the relevant objectives, and now on the face of it, got a U-turn?
From my reading of it, I couldn't see anything that directly says as much in those words. 2.7 hectares is the most appropriate means of achieving the end. What it does say is that it's deriving its rationale from the Wanaka Structure Plan 2007, which identified an area of commercial land at that, let's say, Stone Street junction. Based off your questioning, I had a very quick look on the GIS to just get an idea of size. That much I knew, and I thought, well, I'll just let you know the sort of approximate size that the structure plan showed was about 2 hectares. And it interestingly looks to have included the health centre area, which at that time was, I think, probably undeveloped. And it included that within the indicative commercial blob, if you like, on the structure plan. But other than that, and the comments that Tim's already made to you in regards to the McDermott report and idea of scale that they provided, I found nothing further to clearly say 2.7 hectares was the amount for a particular reason.
It will remain one of the great mysteries of the modern world.
Maybe.
Thanks, Mr. Jones. So in terms of the Cardrona Liquid Shopping Centre Zone, you have heard the questions I had to Mr. Heath around not so much the difference in area, but the difference in shape for that area between the council's current position and Officer Willowbridge's submission. And it was about whether the objectives and policies of the zone and what it's trying to achieve would be better served by the long strip along Cardrona Valley Road or the squatter square that's been proposed by the council. That's an area I don't have much guidance on from the evidence.
Like Mr. Heath, I wasn't focused on that shape factor either, but primarily. But I think I would favour the more regular rectangular shape that I'm currently recommending, as opposed to a rectilinear strip alongside the main road. In part at the local shopping centre, of course, it will want to gain custom from its main road location, but that's actually not meant to be its core purpose. So in terms of the objectives and purpose of that zone and the ability to provide a layout, I probably favour the recommended shape in the Section 42A report.
Would that squarer shape you favour be more appealing / attractive on the basis of I've got the resource consent number written somewhere about that proposal currently being processed with the road that might go through? Would that make it more or less of a suitable candidate?
The road going through to the adjacent residential subdivision will provide it with a key collector road or whatever that may end up being in terms of hierarchy, which would be favourable presumably in terms of giving it a logical spot rather than just simply being a small commercial centre in the middle of a paddock. So that would, I think, be logical.
just in a moment of my own introspection, given that neither you or Mr. Heath really considered the shape, am I overthinking it? Does it matter? Would each of the shapes be equally suitable? Or is it something we as a panel should even turn our minds to?
Well, this is such a small sort of spot zone, I suppose, that it's probably worth turning minds to, okay, given there is some scope to do so. And normally with a zoning, you wouldn't get to the point of sketching up, making sure that the shape factor worked. But given that this is likely to be a small scale one-off, may be a small scale one-off development, then it could have some merit to think about that. Mm.
Would I be able to ask, and the Scott might have a view on this, and the Chair might as well, that through the Council's reply, would it be possible just using the Council's zero photography to identify around the district some existing small centres that, broadly speaking, have the kind of characteristics that the Council thinks it seeks from this new centre, and that might give us a bit of guidance on the extent to which the proposed site or the Willow Ridge shape might be the more reliable or equally reliable. It might be that there are no suitable candidates in the district, but it seems to me if we can be pointed to a couple of examples of small little centres that say this is broadly speaking what the council has in mind and here's how it could fit on the site that's been picked, that might bridge the gap, Ms. Jones, between going effectively creating a de facto resource consent, getting too carried away with things, but not just leaving things floating with a question mark of whether it's even fit for purpose.
Mm. And to put that in some context, in the operative district plan, it's called the corner shopping centre zone. And, that might give you some idea.
A corner?
If it's got a wee corner, but that's above,
the
main road and the potential new collector road, and it's really quite small.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, look, in terms of what I just suggested, I'm certainly not proposing it as something I'd like to see. Maybe it's just something the council could think about as it's getting to its reply, the extent to which it might want to shore that up. It might not want to. Turning then to the Wanaka Town Centre overlay, I can't help but have a nagging feel that I've missed something somewhere, in as much as from the submitter's point of view and its evidence, I haven't seen any of the methods proposed that would require the outcomes that the submitter's experts are claiming will result from the change of zone, less vehicle crossings, buildings taking advantage of the requirements of the zone, but they may not, etc. Have I missed something in what the submitter's putting forward there? A rear lane, for instance.
You're saying you can't see how what they're speaking is required in order to achieve the outcome.
Well, I'm trying to understand the basis on which their experts have been quite forceful in suggesting how the zone change will ensure certain superior outcomes to what they're claiming the medium density overlay might be. But I haven't seen that, so I'm just effectively asking you, have you seen any such?
I think the differences are that in their proposal you would have an 8 to 10 metre high building height. Buildings would be built to the road. They would be able to cover 100% of their site, excepting for this 5 metre setback. But other than that, the form that they, and I guess critically, they do not have to provide car parking on site. So they may, so I guess from that, we're connecting that with the fact that there may be some accesses closed to certain sites because they simply wouldn't need an access into the site if it was 100% commercial. And they may not want to have any vehicular movement on the site at all. But I was of the same view that the difference between the two outcomes is not significant, and on balance, after really careful consideration of it, I think the medium density residential Vulcan location is more appropriate.
Commissioner, I wonder if I can interpolate a query just out of that answer.
Sure, sure, sir.
Ms. Jones, you said those outcomes would result. Should it be could? That those are enabling provisions, not requiring provisions?
Oh, did I say would result in a similar form?
No, it would result in 10 to 8 meters
could,
built
yeah,
a road.
Absolutely, could. And in respect of the setback to the road, though, it is actually would require us to consent if they wanted to set the building back. It's not just that they're allowed to have it on the road, they're actually required to have the built form directly abutting the road boundary. So if it was a house, it would need to be, short of getting a reckless consent, it would need to be on the boundary.
So that is a would be on the boundary?
Would be on the boundary, as of right. Could go to 8 to 10 metres in height and could go to a higher building coverage.
Thank you. You've, based on just your brief CV and your evidence with Jones, you're extremely familiar with the district, Wanaka and Queenstown. The proposal of the submitter to not require car parking isn't the same thing as saying they're not allowed car parking. And so if individual owners still chose to provide parking, say for instance if there was apartments upstairs above shops or customer parking or staff parking or whatever parking, there's nothing in the proposed provisions that would prevent them.
No.
Is that correct?
No, that's right. And we have examples of that in the town centres where they're not required to provide car parking, but certainly...
Ah, good. Well, that's what I wanted to ask you in your experience of was the assumption that the applicant's experts are making, that just because you don't have to, then no one will. And you're suggesting there are examples where, in similar circumstances, people have still provided car parking.
Hmm. There are. I mean, certainly, most don't.
Sure.
But the Naitahu development in Queenstown, basement car parking, private basement parking. I believe the Bella Vista Hotel in Wanaka has parking on site. That's a couple of examples off the top of my head. But by and large, of course, the developers don't have to provide parking, they won't. But I would have thought in that location where medium density residential, most people with permanent residential housing, they may well choose to provide a car park.
If, on consideration of all the evidence and the facts, this panel came to the view that it supported the urban form outcomes the submitter is asserting, in part justify the town centre zone rather than the medium density zone.
Mm-hmm.
But we did not agree with the waiving of any car parking requirement. To what extent, in your view, would the reimposition of car parking and vehicle crossings of itself undermine the qualities that the submitter is asserting will eventuate on the street that justify the town centre zone?
Mm. Well, then I think you're getting even closer to really the fact that there's really not much in it between the two different zones, because as soon as you then require an on-site car parking, you're chipping away at that 100% building coverage anyway. You're necessitating the need for the accessways.
In terms of the suggestion of a rear lane servicing all the lots, which, if there was a parking requirement, could be a means of still allowing for parking without eroding the frontage and all the driveways, as you just said. But again, is there any methods either in the submitter's provisions or that the council uses otherwise that could compel or require such an outcome across multiple different land ownerships?
Mr. Greaves has... I'm trying to think through what Mr. Greaves' provisions do say. They have a policy regarding car parking, wanting car parking and access to be a matter of discretion at the time of building. But then that applicant would turn to the transport section and find that they didn't have to provide any car parking.
But if it's already multiple ownerships and I own one site...
And then if it's a multiple ownership, no provisions thus far are requiring the landowners to work together. For example, you know, thou shalt not do anything until there's a comprehensive development plan for the entire block, which shows a rear lane or a mid-block lane or something, blah, blah, blah. You know, none of that's not in there. And not to say it couldn't be in there, but it's more complication, and it, as I've been saying, my rebuttal evidence, my experience, can stifle development because of the difficulties in getting all those parties together to achieve that comprehensive development plan prior to any, you know, individual site development occurring. So in theory, the methods are there available. Whether they would achieve the purpose and the objectives that we're going for, I think is questionable.
So one thing I think I've heard you say is that it could be a fair question for us to put to that submitter. Would it be prepared, if we were to agree with the fundamentals being sought, a requirement that all the land be planned in one go and the rear lane be delivered in one go, as a requirement before any of that redevelopment occurred?
That's a question you could put
to them. But in terms of planning, the district plan already has comprehensive type requirements, as you just reminded me.
Yeah, in different areas.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, I think that's
one thing. Follow up. Given the limits of the submission, is there in fact scope to impose the kind of provision that Commissioner Munro's has in mind on the face of the submission?
I mean, they don't just seek town centre, they seek town centre with a transition overlay with particular provisions. I would need to go back and look at the actual submission and how much detail that goes into. I think to answer that question, I'm thinking more about the evidence and what it's suggesting as the solution.
Would you be able to do that before gets the evidence to provide to us through council a view? Because if the answer is no, we've got a long time, when Verena appeared, and if the answer is yes, then perhaps it will be all off. Commissioner Housel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a follow-up question from one that Commissioner Munro put to you, and that was going back to the Cadrona Valley corner shopping zone provision. What I was wondering is if it's actually necessary to fix either the shape or the precise location of that zone as part of this process, or whether it can be shown as an indicative zoning of a maximum size of X hectares or metres, and whether the restrictions that you've suggested and that Mr. Heath has supported relating to the maximum footprint within it. So I wondered if that might get around some of the constraints that have been identified relating to shape, and leave it up to the developer to work that through along with the recommended residential zoning of the balance of the land.
My understanding is that the zone would need to be set, or couldn't be indicative in the zoning map, in order to give sufficient certainty to the rules and the land underneath. So I think in order to achieve what perhaps you're getting at, you would need to go to a bigger zone area, and then be very careful with your standards in terms of the amount, like we've got the 3,000 square metres of commercial and commercial and office space, for example, and the 75% coverage, and through those standards you need to very carefully ensure there was only a certain amount of buildable, developable area within the zoned area. It wouldn't be my preference. I wouldn't support an indicative zone boundary, and I wouldn't necessarily support the approach of increasing it in size were given with the one hand and making it bigger, but then saying within this you can only do a much, much lesser amount of development. Well, we have had indicative lines on maps in the operative district plan here in the Queensland Lakes district plan, but they're very clearly indicative lines and they're up for argument and debate at every resources hearing as to which side of the line you're in, or in this case which zone are you actually in, which rules actually apply. Are you in low density residential, or are you in the corner in the local shopping centre zone in this example?
If we are of mind to accept the recommended reduction in the zone size, then isn't that of necessity going to involve an arbitrary decision about the boundary of it?
Yes, I thought in terms of the question of whether they should be set or indicative, I think they should be set zone boundaries that are not up for debate at the time of resource consent.
Would you expect that prior to development subdivision would occur to separate the commercial component from the balance?
I've seen it done both ways in this district.
The reason for my line of inquiry on this is because I've seen the opposite happen as well, where in new areas or undeveloped areas, the council has identified that there's a need for a small local zone, but actually, fixed it. And then the developer comes along and says, well, it's actually in the wrong place, mm-hmm. I want to move it 50 metres up the road, or mm-hmm. I want to change the shape. And then that creates its own issues, either having to address all of it through a resource consent application, or eventually introduce a change to the plan, whether by variation or rezoning. So you've indicated why you would go down that particular track of fixing it, but just wanted to understand whether there would be any downside from looking at the alternative, and I suppose whether we have that scope anyway.
Yes, yeah. The only other parallel I can think of in this district where we do allow some movement is within our special zones. You've got a zone and then within that you've got activity areas, and we enable those activity areas to move plus or minus 100 metres, let's say, and still be deemed to adhere to the structure plan. And that to allow for that same scenario that you were discussing, in terms of once you've actually done your detailed design work, sometimes it doesn't quite fit into the polygon you've been given. So that's one area that this district plan does deal with it in that way.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Mr. McLeod. Resisting the temptation to ask over the coroner's submission.
No, I will remove myself from any questions on the medium density residential zone, given that there's a sensational cinema in that zone everyone should go to. The one question on Mrs. Boyd's evidence, and it's the photo film, that's 4.24, figure 4.3, and it's got a little confused, but it's easy for a stop to be. You see that bit? There's one on the back side, which is Willow Ridge's hatched, and then you flip over and there's one on the other side, and it's got a bright pink section and a flesh coloured section, which is 1 hectare, and it's got 43.1.1 metres. What is the 43.1.1 metres relate to? I'm assuming the hectare is the area.
I think it's when I read that, I think.
Is that on Orchard Road?
I think it's.
Cadrona Valley Road? Or?
Sorry,
the,
to interrupt.
The area is the height above sea level.
No, I helped Ms. Bailey's with that when we were drafting our reports, and that's the perimeter of the polygon that was captured it's the perimeter lineal measurements.
Oh.
Gotcha.
So they're not relevant, but
okay.
Given the constraints today, we still going in.
Crack on.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
We've got a hectare with a thousand. There you go.
Whatever it is, it's not relevant.
It's not relevant. Thanks for that. What's that? 10,000 square metres, yeah. We do, but it's not relevant. That's not my question.
Ms. Jones, just some details about the resource consent application for the road through the local shopping centre. First of all, who's the applicant?
I think it's something to do with the Gordon family.
It's a Gordon family vehicle of some kind.
I believe, but I would actually need to double check, Mr. White.
We'll get out, Kim, then.
I'm not sure, and I haven't been involved at all in the processing of it.
So I've written down Gordon family vehicle, but check with Sebastian. The other question related to the application is, can you give us any guidance as to the time scale of the likely to be determined at first instance?
I haven't followed it up again, but we certainly can sort of reply if you'd like. And my evidence, and my rough evidence, I know that the hearing is anticipated in mid-June.
Well, again, I can ask Mr. White that question, so don't worry about that. The thought that's going through my own mind is whether the option mooted by Mr. Heath is in fact viable. I suspect not. In terms of your, Ms. Bobius, but now your evidence in chief, talking about the health centre going to like shopping centre zone.
Paragraph 5.22?
Correct.
Yes, sorry.
And the issue about going to 75% or enabling 75% site coverage. The question is, well, what's the site coverage now? So what's the incremental difference?
Now, that was not very easy. I did actually look into that myself. I can tell you that in terms of the health centre, it's 23%. And I would need to come back to you in terms of the retirement village site. Because it wasn't clear from my reading of the resource consent and the council's error photographs don't show that it exists yet. It seems to be dates of when they've last flown their GIS aerials. So I've certainly come back to you on that. As a guide, the health centre was 23% according to the resource consent decision.
Right, and if you could do that, please. Because in terms of Mr. Ledgerwood's I actually have the same question. What's the gross floor area of the existing consented and or existing developments that are discussed at 6.3?
I'll need to come back to you on that as well. I can't answer that. It has a yes, but I won't.
The other leading question, I read 6.3 and 6.4. You have a consent for a cafe building and a consent for a restaurant and a museum that now operates as a wedding and function centre.
Mm-hmm.
Is the operation as a wedding and function centre in fact in compliance with the resource consent?
The So the wedding and function seem to have look to have its own variation to that original consent. 6.4.
Well, like I was just saying that.
Oh.
If you look at the previous paragraph, it says approved minor amendments to the previously approved site plan.
Yes, I can certainly look and double check that the wedding function centre has consent.
Okay. Well, that might be an interesting discussion, Mr. Edgewood. And again, with reference to Mr. Ledgewood, and assuming his existing operations are indeed lawful, is there a case for rezoning the land that is currently occupied by commercial activity, there's wedding and function centre, the restaurant, cafe? Like he's asked for a much larger area, but is there a case, dare I say it, applying the existing environment, which may or may not be applicable on the plan process, by recognising that at least?
Well, it's certainly a stronger argument. I guess my opinion on that is that the existing operations, particularly the wedding venue, for example, is not consistent with the objectives of the local shopping centre zone or the business mixed use zone. A much higher density mixed use with higher density housing, you know, and commercial on the ground type of purpose. So it just doesn't, you know, we don't have a zone where it fits seamlessly into, particularly with the park-like setting and the low building coverage that is, you know, obviously the case on that site. And so it's certainly preferable to zoning that whole, like, very large area, but I can't reconcile the logic of having a local shopping centre in that location, right on the edge of the urban growth boundary, with one only a few hundred metres north of it.
This is an issue I should have canvassed with Mr. Heath. We'll see if he can assist us. Part of the Verena case is founded on a premise that there is, in fact, demand for additional town centre and commercial space. Is that view correct in your view?
I cite some data from the McDermott report in my rebuttal evidence, which talks about there being, talks about there it potentially being at capacity in a 5-year period. That was based on the notified PDP town centre zone provisions. My opinion, and no disrespect to that report, I would have thought, my feeling is there was considerable capacity still in the town centre zone. And I add to that, as I noted in my rebuttal, evidence that the various amendments that have been recommended by council through the town centre hearing increase the capacity within the existing town centre boundaries by some 5%, so not hugely, but they do add some upper floor space, and they add some milk ground floor space as well, and that we have removed the building coverage limitations. So my view is that there's considerable space within the town centre still. My professional opinion is there's far more than 5 years worth of capacity within the town centre. And I also note that there's considerable business land available in the wider context of the Upper Clutha when you consider the like shopping centres, three parks, the business mixed use areas. And then I make the comment that I don't believe that the Wanaka Town Centre needs to continually expand based just simply on commercial need. But I don't think that will serve
its objectives. That one final point arising out of your rebuttal, your 7.4 and your policy notes of 7.4 to 7.6. Put to you the proposition that your analysis is a little circular, because if you define the block that Verena have made submission on as part of the town centre, you reach one conclusion, and if you define it as not being within the town centre, you reach a different one. So it doesn't actually help us decide what the correct zoning is. So I'll put that to you.
In terms of what policies or objectives you are attempting to achieve?
Yes, and whether those policies and objectives would be served.
Well, I think the objectives of both the NDR and the town centre zone are better achieved through the NDR zoning. Because I think it just better supports, it supports the town centre as opposed to directly competing with it. It provides medium density residential housing within close proximity of a main centre. More land would occur under the town centre zoning. It's better and it's more sensitive to its surrounding character. And I mean, some of those are strategic directions, objectives, as opposed to sitting either within the town centre zone or the medium density residential zone. So they apply equally, regardless of which angle you're coming at it from.
Thank you very much, Ms. Jones. Any more for any more? Appreciate your assistance.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jones.
And stepping in from those buggies.
No problem.
We now turn to Mr. Farr. We have a copy of his statement too.
Thank you.
Yes, that's right. Is that not there in the care file?
I could have done it myself, thank you, boys.
Okay.
I'll do that next time. Thank you.
Just for the record, Mr. Barr has prepared a strategic overview and common themes statement. The Group 1, Section 42A evidence, which is from Urban and Bay Carrier. Group 2, which is Wanaka Urban Scheme. And Group 3, which is rural. He has also prepared a revised supplementary statement of evidence relating to dwelling capacity and then his robust evidence. Also, we have a copy of his evidence summary. And when he is settled and set up and comfortable, I'll ask him to read that to you.
Yes, we have. We've noticed he's been busy.
And then remain with knowledge of the paper.
Thank you. I am the author of the Strategic Overview and Common Themes, Group 1A, Wanaka Urban and Lake Kawea, Group 2, Wanaka Urban Fringe, Group 3, Rural Evidence and respective rebuttals. I am also the author of the Supplementary Statement of Evidence on Dwelling Capacity. This summary statement is broadly grouped into two themes, the Council's approach to zoning and the submission to rezone land. The Council's approach to zoning. Chapter 4, Urban Development, sets out the objectives and policies for managing the spatial location and layout of urban development within the district. This chapter forms part of the strategic directions, strategic intentions of this district plan and will guide planning and decision making for the district's major urban settlements and smaller urban townships. The chapter will apply to both Volume A and B land. The Urban Development chapter builds on Goal 2 of the strategic directions and associated policy framework being the strategic and integrated management of urban growth. The Urban Development chapter contains 7 objectives with associated policies. The first 3 objectives seek that urban development is integrated with infrastructure, that urban growth boundaries are established and have distinct defendable urban edges, and within the urban growth boundaries a compact and integrated urban form is encouraged that makes efficient use of infrastructure. 2 objectives are specific to Wanaka. Objective 4.28 and related policies manage the scale and location of urban growth to retain and protect the key entrances to the town, seeks to maintain the distinction between urban and rural areas, avoids the ad hoc development of rural land, and that ONS and ONLs are protected from encroachment by urban development. Objective 429 and related policies seeks to provide an outcome within the Wanaka UTP that supports increased density to avoid sprawling into rural areas, facilitates the diversity of housing supply, maximises the efficiency of existing infrastructure networks, and that rural land outside the UTB is not developed until further investigations indicate that more land is needed to meet demand. The Council's amended dwelling capacity model outputs incorporating both feasibility and realisable capacity considerations as explained by Mr. Osborne provide for an overall capacity in the upper cluster of 6,615 dwellings against a projected demand of approximately 5,000 dwellings out of the year 2048. This shows that there is more than sufficient capacity for urban development available within the upper Clutha in appropriate locations. The majority of capacity is within the Wanaka UGB, and in my view there is no need to amend the Wanaka UGB or rezone additional land for residential purposes to meet the estimated demand. In addition to the housing supply provided within the Wanaka UGB, I consider that the location and extent of the Wanaka UGB is appropriate and gives effect to the CDP urban development chapter because it will ensure the character of the key entrance to Wanaka and the distinction between urban and rural areas is maintained, retained. and will provide certainty to the council for the investment and provision of infrastructure and promote the efficient use of this infrastructure. Landscapes are a significant resource to the district and region and require protection from inappropriate activities that could degrade its qualities, character and values. The TDP Landscapes chapter provides a framework that gives effect to the Strategic Directions chapter, the Operative Otago Regional Policy Statement in Section 6A, D and 7 of the Act. The Urban Development chapter dovetails with the Landscape chapter and rural zones by discouraging ad hoc urban development in the rural zone. I consider that the spatial application of zoning and related mapping annotations gives effect to the TDP Strategic Direction chapters by focusing urban growth within the established townships and rural settlements of Luggett, Lake Elliot and Hawea Flat, and with the majority of growth within the Wanaka UDB. The zones within these areas provide a range of housing choices to meet the needs of the district. Concentrating growth within the Wanaka UDB provides certainty to the market and certainty to the council's engineers and asset managers as to where it will plan and provide for infrastructure and obtain endorsement from the council for funding of infrastructure projects through long-term and annual plan processes. The council expects a level of use, intensity and effects on its infrastructure within the Wanaka UDB commensurate for that enabled by the PDB, because this is where infrastructure investment in the network will be planned, is expected to occur and will bring best value for money to the community. The council has provided the adequate capacity of urban development within the Wanaka UDB and township settlements, and any proposals to extend the Wanaka UDB existing settlements of Luggett and Lake Awea or create new settlements would need to fully address the consequences of extending the council's network and effects on the pattern of settlement contemplated by the PDP. The strategic and urban development chapters seek to prevent these types of developments from occurring where there was a ad hoc development and sprawl, particularly before the development capacity provided for within the Wanaka UDB is realised. Related to this, I consider that the PDP is not designed to, nor should it be designed to leave the chance the provision of network infrastructure associated with areas zoned for development, and this is why areas of greenfield urban development land are located within the Wanaka UDB. I consider the PDP subdivision chapter focuses on the installation of infrastructure within the proposed development. However, it also provides policies that require consideration of effects on network infrastructure outside the development site. Overall, however, I consider that the PDP, and in particular the strategic and urban development chapters, do not contemplate the creation of zoned land for resort-style, residential, commercial or industrial land uses on the basis that any infrastructure, installation or upgrades outside the site of the council network would be addressed through subsequent resource consents. I consider that we poor planning practice and would leave the district plan at odds with policies PA1 and PA2 of the National Policy Statement of Urban Development Capacity to allow zoning without adequate consideration and acceptance by the council that the development could be serviced from a network capacity perspective. Submissions to rezone land. My evidence on each specific rezoning is within my evidence in chief and rebuttal, and my summary cannot take you through each of these. However, to assist the panel, I summarise the approach taken to evaluate and provide an overall recommendation on the requested rezonings, including synthesising the respective expert evidence for the council and filed by submitters, and whether this would give effect to the applicable TDP zone, the district-wide and strategic directions chapters, the operative Otago Regional Policy Statement and the Chief Part 2 of the Act. A range of rezoning assessment principles have been identified and evaluations undertaken in light of these guiding principles. These are not intended to be a replacement or surrogate for Section 32 of the Act. However, I consider the rezoning assessment principles are a useful guide as to whether the rezoning request is the most appropriate method to meet the objectives, same as the test set out in Section 32 of the Act. In terms of residential visitor accommodation and commercial activities seeking to locate within rural areas, I consider that the rural zone provides the most appropriate planning framework to manage the effects of activities on the district's landscape resource and to manage potential incompatible activities. In particular, I consider that the rural zone and identification of the landscape boundaries, rural framework and use of the assessment matters in Part 21.7 is the most appropriate method to ensure the district's outstanding natural features and landscapes are protected from inappropriate development. The rural zone framework is also considered to be the most appropriate to maintain and enhance the landscapes that are applicable to Section 7 of the Act and fall under the rural landscape classification. One of the reasons for preferring the retention of the rural zone over other areas that specifically provide for residential over other zones that specifically provide for residential activity in rural areas is that the application of the assessment matters will, in my opinion, ensure that landscapes are protected from inappropriate development and the quality and character of the rural environment is maintained and the PDB landscape chapter is fully considered, and this will ensure the strategic directions chapter is given effect to. Another reason why I prefer the rural zone is that to provide for the requested zonings, both individually and cumulatively, would result in the addition of bespoke provisions inserted into the PDP to manage what would be residential or commercial development in sensitive locations. In drafting the PDP, concerted effort has been made to make the PDP as streamlined as possible while providing sufficient direction as to achieving guidance for decision makers and the purpose of the Act. While this matter is likely to be a distant consideration to the submitters, I consider that it is important in terms of the ease of use for the end user and confidence in the council to administer the district plan. I emphasise that the rural zone discretionary rule framework and the assessment matters provide not appropriate framework for consent that are granted as conditions that ensure the appropriate environmental outcomes are met. The Allenby Farm submission is a case in point, and I consider that if this rezone request is accepted, would lead to a poor outcome in terms of planning provisions when the appropriate path is to apply for discretionary activity resource consent under the rural zone. Several submitters have sought their land to be rezoned to a zone that exists in the ODP, such as the rural visitor zone. I do not consider that it is appropriate to include the rural visitor zone in the PDP without a full review of the zone and its application across the Upper Clutha and wider districts without the opportunity the council would undertake a full review. The ODP rural visitor zone in particular is inadequate in its current form because it enables intensive development without suitable management of the effects of that development. An example being camping grounds and intensive resort development, all being considered broadly as a type of rural visitor activity. In addition, I do not consider the additional site-specific rules proposed by some submitters who manage the visual effects of buildings mostly to overcome the fundamental issues with the zone. However, as set out in council's legal submissions, that is not to say that in some instances a stage 2 type of zone is acknowledged to be more appropriate, and I recommend a variation that lands through stage 2. For these reasons, I consider the PDP's approach to zoning and mapping and annotations is sound, provides adequate housing capacity for the duration of and beyond the expected life of the PDP, and that accept is recommended to be accepted in my evidence in chief or rebuttal that the notified zoning are the most appropriate to give effect to the strategic direction and high rural planning instruments. Glenview Bay Trustees Limited. As identified in my evidence in chief and rebuttal, I have concerns with the requested Glenview Station Zone provisions and that transposing the conditions of the resource consent and the district plan provisions will shift the onus on the consent holder to administer clear but rigid conditions imposed by the Environment Court to a set of unwieldy district plan provisions that would result in uncertainty in terms of administration and ultimately reduce the clarity sought for their environmental outcomes in this area. I accept that the consent conditions are rigid, but cannot extend this to sympathise with the submitter because they reflect the sensitivity of the environment and the activity sought. Putting aside the procedural components identified in my rebuttal evidence, I consider that in the current form the requested GSC provisions are also too enabling and do not provide sufficient certainty to manage activities appropriately within the O&L. I maintain my view that the 2,631-hectare requested open space farm area component of the zone is retained as rural zone. In particular, this would enable the O&L assessment matters to apply to this land for any discretionary or non-compliant activity where landscape is at issue. I also consider that the combination of the size of the farm homestead activity area at 19.23 hectares and liberal rural framework does not provide sufficient certainty that activities provided will meet the objectives of the strategic directions chapters. For example, buildings in the farm homestead activity area are controlled activity, and the rules limiting the scale and intensity of buildings and contemplated activities are limited only to rules controlling building height and limiting the footprint to 500 metres squared where the building is within 100 metres of a road. I reaffirm these views in this summary as a wish to be taken into account if the panel is minded to direct some form of without prejudice conferencing on the GSC framework. Thank you, and I can see why we like to stick to 2 pages.
Yes, indeed. I could address the last point first. I don't intend to form a view on the desirability of conferencing until I see the Lindsay Bay team, because I could perceive the likelihood that we might see a third iteration of their provisions since they seem to be redrawing them on the hoof. And we'll see what we're dealing with and then figure out the best way to deal with it. Now, the way I intend to run this bar is that, as you saw with Ms. Nelsoff's evidence, we're going to do this in sections and get all the questions on each section before we move to the next. And in particular, that will mean our submitter by submitter or section by section of your evidence. And so I think that means we start with the strategic overview and common themes, and you've helpfully separated it into parts. So we'll deal with these questions on part A, which is the first. Or 22.5 pages of Ms. Barr's strategic evidence. Can you volunteer to go first? Well, on the massive tide of enthusiasm to my right and left, but I will start by asking a question that you've heard me ask in other hearings. I haven't seen in your revised Section 32 analysis, and I have a question as to whether in the Section 32 analysis that's been done to support the notified plan, there is a quantified assessment of costs and benefits. And the question is, does that pose a problem for us? Should we be concerned that there is no quantification of costs and benefits? Is it in fact practical to assess those costs and benefits in a quantified way? So let's start with the Section 32 analysis, which I have to confess I haven't been through. So is there a quantified costs and benefits in there?
No, not by a qualified expert as such, but any concerns associated with those being absent from the Section 32s, I think, should be alleviated by the use of, for instance, property economics to provide more quantified sort of costs in terms of market and retail impacts through the course of the hearings. Some of the strategic chapters in particular are quite high level, and at the time, and obviously the council's planning capacity model has become more refined since then, and now we're in a position where it's to the fore, so to speak. So I think that essentially supports the council's case without an issue of that being absent in the Section 32 as notified. The rural landscape Section 32 did include the rural zone as well as the landscape chapter, and there are provisions in the rural zone that I expect could have been quantified more readily. They were quantified from an overall planning perspective, but not from a market or retail impact or economic impact. But having said that, those hearings have been held, and the council is happy with its position on those.
I was thinking more of the matters that we have to address, the location of the zone. Like, I'm not saying that the submitters have produced a qualified analysis, because I haven't seen one at NLEM they've produced either. But I remain concerned. Can we confidently say that it is not practicable to assess the to quantify the costs and benefits of all of the zoning choices that are either notified or you've recommended to the extent they've changed? And maybe I should have asked Ms. Jones that question for the one she is responsible for, but since you're in charge of, it seems like, 95% of the district, or this half of the district.
Except for the case of the Drona Valley Road local shopping centre zone, the spatial location of the zone hasn't fundamentally changed. Large lot residential has identified an area that we can have effectively double the density. But fundamentally, I stand by the fact that I think that the section 32 is putting aside the local shopping centre zone issue fit for purpose, and where required or where it was going to be of assistance to the panel, I think the costs have been quantified through the course of the hearings.
Yeah. Paragraph 4.1, this is a list of the matters that in your view are not part of stage one. I want to go to G, contact energy submission, seeking the OL classification to be removed from the hydro generation zone. Hydro generation zone is not notified in stage one, but I think despite the inverse of the proposition I put to Ms. Scott when she opened the council's case about whether the O&L lines should be on zones that are before us, you said the application to remove them is not part of this hearing, this phase of the district plan review, but Ms. Scott's argument to me was, well, the O&Ls are part of this plan review, so doesn't it follow that to the extent that the submission relates to the the presence of the O&Ls on the plan, it's part of our bailiwick, so to speak.
Yes, I agree that submission should have been included in this round.
Unfortunately, they are not appearing or giving any evidence.
No. They were served notice, the statement about their submission. So they still would have been served notice, and if they disagree, then they could appear. They're not appearing. So that, I can put on record, that statement is wrong, and the O&L lines should apply over that land. The hydro generation zone is an overlay over the rural zone. The only person who benefits from that zone is somebody undertaking a hydro generation activity. Otherwise, the rural zone rules will apply to you. That's how it's my reading of the operative district plan and how that works. So similar to a serious subzone, and that subzone sees the benefit of people, persons undertaking scary activities.
And on the basis that it's before us, what is your view? Should it go or should it stay?
My view is that it should stay, because for the reason that the hydro generation zone provides a development right to persons, or more likely a person who seeks to undertake hydro generation activities, Lake Hawea, Hawea River and the Clutha River. If that annotation was removed, there'd be a lot more people who own private land affected by that overlay who should be subject to the O&L and ONF boundaries. And in any case, I don't see the identification of the O&L and ONF boundaries over where there is a hydro generation overlay to be necessarily inhibit that, because the hydro generation zone provides a certain development right, or at least in terms of Volume B or the operative plan. Should note that obviously that zone is up for review as part of Stage 2, and I'm aware of Contact Energy disposing of some land along the Clutha River, so there'll be a conversation about whether or not they'd like to include that, the full extent of the hydro generation zone in Stage 2 of the review if that's done.
My understanding is that those development proposals are certainly in the Luggett area of the abandoned. Question at 8.1, I'm bringing it to part 2. So we'll stop there and go to the other questions.
Thanks, Stephen Wright. At section 6, and you go through the other documents, I just wanted to test with you the relevance of some of those. I mean, some of those community plans are over 15 years old. To what extent is that credibly still relevant to us? They've been listed as things that were done, but do they materially help us today in 2017?
I know a few locals who would say otherwise. I think because
they're not here though. You're here.
Yes, I think they are relevant, and to the extent that the Wanaka UGB reflects the inner growth boundary of the 2007 structure plan, it's perhaps, I hate to say it, but it's simply taken that long to give effect to those non-statutory plans. To be fair, the Luggett and the Hawea community plans are still relevant, but largely because those communities still resemble those plans. If there was a craze of urban resource consents in the rural zone, sort of south of Cemetery Road or on the outskirts of Luggett, which hasn't really happened except for the Delta Holdings or the land owned by Willow Ridge now, then it might be a different story, and I would have had to have said, well, sure, get a hold of the resource consents. But when you compare those documents to what we still see today, they still seem to have some sort of coherence.
I had in my mind, particularly when I asked that question, the Hawea one, and the submissions that have said we'd like to be upzoned because that's what the Hawea plan said, but council officers are saying, no, don't change it, doesn't matter. So I'm trying to get a sense of when we should give primacy to these documents you've just said are still very relevant and represent the community wishes, and when we should ignore them, as sometimes the council's own staff seem to have done.
Yes, I'm aware of that. I don't think I've ignored that document there. I just think the environment that Dean created is what it is. And there are some clear statements saying that if there is any further urban development in the Lake Hawea settlement, it makes sense to go up, you know, to encroach into that rural residential zone up that corner of Cemetery Road. That doesn't mean to say it should happen. And there's been quite, there's some quite strong submissions in the rural hearing about people saying, don't upzone my land. Arguably they probably turned up a year early, I'm afraid, because they probably should be turning up here rather than last May when we had the hearings here for the rural zones. But when I was considering those submissions as well, and like I set out in my 42A, when I looked at the circumstances and the environment that's been created, I was sort of dissuaded to retain the status quo. That's also on the back of the council's BCM outputs, and that there is no need to push for infill in that part of the district.
So it sounds like what you're saying, and please correct me if I've not got this right, that we should rely on the community plans unless in the meantime some status quo has changed on the land.
Potentially, but even then I think the reliance could be an overstatement. I just think that it could be used as guiding principles, really. I don't think I could rely on them. Could be a bit keen. But having said that, I wouldn't want to understate the importance of them to the community.
All right, well, I'm not going to ask you any more questions on that. the statutory requirements, this is now 65 of your strategic report, I'm still in my mind unclear, and this was something I raised with Ms. Scott at the start, I'm still unclear what it is you're recommending we should be considering the submissions against. I understand the criteria, and they're quite common, I get that. But in terms of section 32, my key question is whether or not it is sufficient for us to consider submissions against the strategic objectives and policies of the plan, given that that is what the zones have been primarily developed to implement. Or, for instance, when we're considering the merits of reducing a local shopping centre zone at Cardrona Valley Road, we should go and subject it to the Otago Regional Policy Statement. And so you've said a few times, including in your summary, that you see the zoning alternatives as methods to implement the objectives of the wider strategic section of the plan. Now, if that's your advice and we were to agree with it, that's a very clear sphere of what it is we're actually subjecting these evaluations to. But at the same time, it seems that you've gone beyond those to think about Part 2 of the Act directly, to think about the ORC. And so I just want you to just clarify as much as you can to help me. What is the target I should be aiming for when I'm evaluating alternative zones?
I see the chances. Fundamentally, it's whether or not if the zone would give effect to strategic directions.
Well, that alone might actually be helpful, in as much as it could be that instead of you being definitive, it's one or the other, it's primarily the strategic. And maybe on a case-by-case basis, if we need to deal with any ambiguity or further doubt, we start thinking ahead of those or beyond those. Is that a fairer way of capturing what you're...
Yes, it also comes to the scale and nature of the of the change requested from, or the departure from, the notified provisions. I think issues like Mr. Verifid's submission will extend beyond the strategic directions of the plan. I think to an extent, Blindu Station Zone, I think strategic directions of the proposed plan are important, but I think given the scale of the zone, given the way that zone would change the character over and above what's consented, I think that needs to sort of extend to, might sort of extend beyond that as well, and especially in terms of the, well, I think that there's also some components of the strategic direction chapter sort of gives effect to the part two of the act as well. So in terms of providing for well-being and enablement, I think it's in the strategic as well.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you a Team Family kind of question about if the strategic section has done its job, and we presume it has, why would we look beyond it?
Mm.
Just to seize the moment, the Beresford's question, is there an argument that this is the genuine exception that requires reference to part two, because chapter five, the reasons of the council's submission, really doesn't think about that. The combination of circumstances on a site which is not in fact a cultural site, but to which arguably the principles of the treaty might still apply.
That's right. I'd be bold enough to say that if the PDP became, if the strategic directions became operative tomorrow, then that's what I'd be looking to if I was administering the consent. But Mr. Beresford's submission is that exception. And it's that exception because I don't think Chapter 5 in the PDP contemplates the situation. I don't think the operative policy statement is helpful either.
I think so. I just following on from that, and the word the exception, rather than possibly one of few, I wonder if it would be possible for you just to put the thinking cap on and provide to us a short list of those submissions that you think there could be a case for a wider than the strategic sections consideration. Maybe it's not something you can do now, it could possibly be given to us in writing, but Mr. Chair, I think that might be quite helpful, just if Mr. Buck would explicitly say, for these reasons, these submissions maybe do warrant that broader analysis.
Certainly, but for want of, I will go away and think some more, but if I had to answer it right now, I wouldn't go past the Beresford submission. It would be the only one.
Oh. Alright. Well, it might be that simple. But that's all I've got for that section. So.
Well, that would be a short list.
Yeah. Just use a big box, maybe.
Commissioner Hudson. Part A, yes, please.
Yeah, I just following on from Mr. Munro's points of it, a non-statutory document, the one of the 2020 structure plan, the local plan, there wouldn't be a week that goes by that I don't, somebody doesn't quote to me that we're not doing it and we're not applying what happened in the 2020 process. I was interested in your comment about it's taken this long. Was that your genuine thought? It's just taken this long to work its way through. Is that a thinking barrier, or was that just working its way into the system in terms of how it should be applied? And I asked this with the context that I was at a Shaping a Future Transport Committee meeting, and a gentleman stood up in front of the whole group and said, we sat down the 2020 process, these need to be enshrined in the district plan. And I actually said to him, I thought we were getting there.
Yeah. Yes, we are. 10 years on is quite a spell. Then again, we notified the proposed district plan nearly 2 years ago. All I can say, sir, is that it would, if their schedule processes were faster, that would be better.
As in, if I was sitting to the left of Vladimir Putin as opposed to the democratic system?
Yeah. But going back to Mr. Munro's questions, I don't want to understate the importance of those documents to the community, but having said that, I'm not going to blindly follow them just because they're there and time has moved on from them.
I would agree. I mean, also an example being everyone says we have parking problems and whatever. We don't, we have walking problems. The one other thing, 6-9, and this was pointed out to me by a lady in 6-9B, retaining existing residential rule at Hallowfleet flat, and it's actually John. The name of the family was the John family, as opposed to, so it's a surname, not a first name, so it's John Creek, as opposed to John's Creek.
Okay, so not even an apostrophe, just John
just
Creek.
John Creek, yeah. As in the surname, not the first name. Which was, it's interesting to hear you talk about the Beresford's permission being a genuine exception, because it does seem to be genuinely exceptional, and I think you addressed that in your description about how it sits within the treaty settlement. And there was a bit of, oh, we'll get to that, I suppose. There was just discussion about the crown. Yeah, we'll get to that.
Well, if we can move on to part B, which is the strategic direction, zoning structure, part 9, so part section 7 through 10. Again, I'll kick this off. What I was going to say is 8.8. Roads are not zoned with the PDP. I know the formal roads are not zoned, because, but where in the text does it say, like I'm perfectly willing to be told it somewhere, but where in the text does it say that unformed roads are not zoned?
I don't, if it says it anywhere, it says it in the notified designations chapter. As far as the planning maps are concerned, a road is a road. They're not shown as having a zone, and if you open up any page, you'll probably see a road that isn't formed, and you wouldn't know that unless you saw an aerial photo and thought that was probably going up a mountainside. And the simplest ones are the Grandview Road going up the side of, you know, Grandview Hill. Mountains, that doesn't exist. Lagoon Valley Road doesn't exist. Someone's driveway. So there's no distinction between formed roads and unformed legal roads, nor are there rules for them.
So I wonder if I could ask you to look at that, because obviously it's a matter of some import as regards the submission for the O&L at Albertown, whether it includes Ms. Malsop's, actually Dr. Reed's evidence. Might be that maybe your rebuttal says, produces the planning map which shows that the formed road is not zoned. But my interest is in the unformed but legal road. And so if there is somewhere in the plan that support the statement.
Yes.
If you could refer me to where it is. And a related question. What zone do stock roads have?
They follow a process which is also set out in the designations chapter, which they seem to be deemed the least intensive zoning going from rural up to town centre.
The least
intensive form of zoning from rural to town centre.
How do you decide which?
I haven't had the opportunity yet. I think it's obviously the adjoining zone or the zone that if there's two different zones on either side of the road, the less intensive zone, and there's a hierarchy of that. It's certainly in the notified version of the designations chapter on the roads. I need to check to see the status in terms of the council officers' versions.
That's just following my own curiosity, so you don't need to worry about that. That's all I had on that part B.
Okay, I've got some questions on the, largely arising from your summary actually about the national policy statement. And in your summary you drew out the policies PA1 and PA2. And I wanted to ask your interpretation of PA1. You're on that page?
Yep.
So as I had hitherto interpreted it in the context of the PDP, I'll just wait for my colleagues. Are we all on we're all there? Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I had interpreted this as meaning of whatever residential and business land was zoned, a proportion of it, which may be all of it, but may be less than all of it, but was determined to be sufficient, had to meet the requirements of one of these three. But as I read your evidence in your summary, it strikes me that you might be interpreting PA1 as if it says, local authorities shall ensure that all land identified for housing and business land developments has capacity according to the table below. Because you've suggested we couldn't possibly support submissions for rezoning when there isn't infrastructure because it wouldn't meet PA 1 and 2. But if that land was over and above whatever was deemed sufficient and had to meet the requirements of the NPS, that I would have thought that might still float there. So it struck me that maybe I've read PA 1 wrong.
I don't think you have, sir. I think but in the context of the Upper Clutha and the evidence that there is adequate housing or adequate capacity within planned areas, I don't think there is a need to, identify zoned land for future growth. That would probably involve, it would most certainly involve qualifiers and what would end up probably being rules around perhaps that land not being developed until other land has been developed first, until XYZ occurs in terms of infrastructure. If we hadn't got there in terms of our DCM outputs, I think that's something that you'd reasonably contemplate. But my interpretation of that policy was probably undertaken on a relatively narrow view with what the council's DCM outputs are, and I didn't really need to think I had to lean on support from submissions who were perhaps wanting zoning on the periphery of somewhere and couldn't be serviced at this point in time.
Yes, it may well be that we agree that the council has met its requirements under the NPS, but the Act no longer says necessity is a requirement to grant a particular zone, nor is there a presumption. This is Mr. Chair, Section 32 used to say there had to be a need, although necessity was interpreted as meaning desirable rather than necessary, as you know. So the fact that it may not be needed to satisfy any particular capacity may not of itself be sufficient for us to determine not to support a submission. It might just be that it can't rely on an NPS type benefit in its favour.
That's right.
But I'm interested in the comments you made about finding oneself quickly in a point of needing some kind of additional rules or provisions about requiring infrastructure or satisfying infrastructure. And it does relate to your comments about the subdivision section and what it intended and what it provided for. And your comments that it didn't anticipate sorting these things out later. I want to ask two questions on that. The first is, are we left in a position where unless council staff decide they can service development, we can't support upzoning, i.e. does the council officers under the LGA actually become the decision makers for supporting zone requests by submitters? Because it does, I think submitters could come to us and make that argument to us, and it would be difficult for us to set them aside based on some of the comments that have been given to us by staff. And that's something that Scott probably needs to think about too. Because it seems that the council nominates zoning, does its Section 32 analysis, satisfies itself, and can fund it. Of course, no submitter making a submission through this process is likely to already have an LTP lined up with funding for their site in place, is there? So I'm interested to understand to what extent a literal application of infrastructure must be lined up and agreed and funded before you can upzone. Might be, and it might be the correct interpretation, but it might nonetheless seriously curtail our ability to consider submissions on their merit.
To be fair, I don't think it's the case where submitters hit a wall and can't go any further. I think someone might have made during the week, but why would you go there? There's enough capacity within settlements and within Wanaka's urban growth boundary.
Yeah, but it's not council staff's decision to decide what land is more worthy of development than others. That's our role based on listening to evidence from submitters.
That's correct.
And so if a submitter says we think our land might be better than some of the council's land, even if taken in conjunction, council's land and our land might be more than is necessary, why would that not be worthy of a zone?
It could well be worthy of a zone, but I think there would need to be more interrogation of the true level of demand of the infrastructure required for that subdivision, and not just within it, but getting to it or extending the council's network to it. And I appreciate that Mr. Gladstone says, well, if the developer's willing to fund it entirely, then that can happen. And those conversations do happen. But looking, not being an engineer myself, but skimming rebuttal evidence that we've seen, a lot of it, just the various evidence springs out to mind, given that it is a reduced submission, but they are sort of still leaning on getting zoning, waiting for it to happen. And I think that conversation needs to happen well before a zone set down.
So, I mean, Mr. Glasner, in his rebuttal evidence was telling, in as much as soon as people started showing how this infrastructure might be serviced, he became much happier about things, which is a very different proposition to it can't be serviced, it's just the council doesn't yet know how it would be. And so is one pathway where we might find ourselves in support of a submission other than the fact of the council's infrastructure concerns. And Scott, again, I'll ask you to think about this too. Is one pathway for us to provide to the council perhaps a recommended list of those submissions that it might further think through for the purposes of its stage two plan change? I.e. the council might not have thought about servicing areas of land that hadn't identified might be appropriate for zoning, but if we as a panel said we think X, Y and Z would be appropriate subject to infrastructure, would that be an option for the council, or has it seen its stages A and B so separated from each other in terms of what zones will and won't be considered that it's a case of this is in fact the only opportunity?
No, not at all. Just going back to the sort of question that you posed, I think going clearly I can't say that you can completely shut the door on those submitted if there can be a solution to it. Not in engineering there is a solution, but I think it would have to be, very clear to those developers or to those submitters or whoever the ultimate developers are that things need to happen before they can initiate their development or as part of lodging subdivision consent. And what they would have to translate to would have to be provisions in the plan that identify shortfalls in capacity and make up for that, which are fairly common in other plans. I don't think there's really many that exist in terms of, I don't think there's any in terms of the proposed district plan.
What's on my mind is not nervousness, but a life anxiety. In light of my agreement with your comments about the need to avoid ad hoc planning, there's a paper trail where through this process the council's experts say an area of land is in fact appropriate for a land use, but it doesn't have infrastructure, so no zone is given. So landowners then just don't use any zone framework, just use resource consents under the rural zone to create clearly non-rural outcomes on the basis of privately funded infrastructure or separately funded infrastructure or a deal with the council's infrastructure team that in fact may in the long term lead to less connected, less integrated, less planned urban born outcomes, actually promoted as a consequence of forcing a rural zone on people in the meantime.
I think under the operative plan that's something you can entertain because it's hinged so heavily on landscape and amenity of a landscape. I think under the proposed district plan, if that became operative tomorrow, with at least the council's understanding of what I think the strategic directions look like, I think you'd struggle to get an urban rezoning outside of the urban growth boundary. I think you'd struggle to get a resource content, even in the Section 7 landscape, adjacent to a settlement.
Even if one produced your evidence and the other evidence of the council staff in this process saying the land was in fact suitable for it, it just didn't have infrastructure? As a 104.1c matter, wouldn't that be compelling to the council to see its own staff saying that the urban use might well be appropriate?
Well, the avenue would probably be a good schedule process because they just might not get over some of the urban development chapter policies.
The other question,
looking at 25.4,
one question. One question, okay. And this again is just for my own peace of mind. On reading your evidence submitters, could well come to us this week and say, Commissioners, Mr. Barr seems to be trying to have his cake and eat it too, because when it comes to giving us certainty with a land use zone, he says you can't rely on the resource consent, we must know things now. But then when it suits Mr. Barr, he says don't give them a zone now, we can use the resource consent process under the rural zone to sort it out later. So how do we reconcile the view that the resource consent is in fact appropriate to sort out things later, when it comes to landscape, SMA, ONL, but it is not okay to sort out things later, such as what's the deal with the council over the infrastructure part?
Two separate land uses, I think, there. I don't think I might need to check, but I don't think with any of my recommendations on urban rezoning, I'll see it leave for a resource consent, because I know in my mind that if the strategic directions are made operative, people might struggle for urban zoning outside of the urban growth boundary. The rural lifestyle zone relative to the rural zone is a different story, and there's generally no expectation at all of 2 hectare average that you're going to get. You're going to have worries about infrastructure. Rural residential, same, those sites are normally big enough to be self-sufficient.
I think that's a helpful partial insulation. My question was really going to the premise of can the resource consent process be dealt with to deal with uncertainties later on. In some respects you're saying it can be, in other respects you're saying no it can't be.
That's right.
And it's that possible inconsistency I'd like to have a clearer understanding of.
Well, I just gave you my answer on where I think I've made recommendations.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't...
But fundamentally either the plan allows people to sort out uncertainty later on, or it requires them to address uncertainty at the time of a zone.
That's right. So for urban zonings,
it must be done.
It must be done now or through a first scheduling process.
Yep.
And that's not to say that if somebody beats the door down after this through an appeal that, or through a variation, those urban growth boundaries could change. But the point you probably read far too much in the Group 3 report and rebuttal is that the rural zone and its regime is designed for people to apply for resource consent. So there's quite a distinction there.
I won't ask my next follow-up questions.
I have some follow-up questions before we break and get the 15 minutes to collect his thoughts and have a coffee, and so we'll return at, I think it's 5 to 4.
We're having a break.
Yeah.
So, people hear anything?
No, that was a break. That was the Mayor's Task Force on Housing Affordability.
Oh, yeah.
I love those task forces.
Light reading.
I'm sure the council could go and buy some decent European luxury liner, ship it in, park it over the lake, and use it as accommodation.
That's right.